Although the potential for research on these vessels is severely limited by the lack of archaeological context, we can't really know how they survived. Were they found in graves? Were they found in hoards like the Oxus treasure? Where in the Persian Empire they were found? We can't really even be sure of their authenticity if they don't come from a secure context. But the gold and silver drinking cups do illustrate in life what we see the tribute bearers bring to the Persian king on the stone sculpture in the royal palaces. If we move from portable goods to more permanent monuments, we gain even more insight into the Achaemenid style employed in its art. We have already examined one monument for its text, the Behistun decree that documented the accession of Darius I. The 10-by-18-foot engraved inscription and relief draws on several cultural and artistic motifs that we have seen during this course, but it adds specifically Persian elements. The concept of a sculpted relief carved into living rock had been known in Iran since the 3rd millennium BC. A 3rd millennium relief of a local Iranian ruler, Anubanani, shows the king stepping on a defeated enemy, just as Darius does in the Behistun relief. The Darius and the Anubanani monuments quote the imagery of the Akkadian ruler, Naram Sin, who showed himself climbing over the bodies of his enemies, the Lulubi. If we contrast this imagery with the Assyrian kings, who were shown in battle or seated on a throne while defeated leaders were brought before them, we see that the Persian king is going back to either an older idea of showing how the king deals with his enemies, or that he is trying to reinforce these Iranian elements that have been known for so long because they were visible from the road. Darius likely chose this archaic mode of representation to help validate his claim to the throne through his military success. One of the important features of the decree is the representation of Ahura Mazda, the supreme deity of the Persians. Ahura Mazda's presence is highlighted the divine approval of Darius. And you remember that the text, which was very widely disseminated in the Persian Empire, in this text, Darius referred to the great lie in the form of Gaumata, the imposter, that Darius helped to uncover. Darius is shown about life size. He's larger than the rest of the figures, who are either his supporters and co-conspirators who stand behind him, or the other rebels who now cower with their hands tied behind their backs in front of him. Darius wears a low crown or a diadem and a loose robe that is typical of Persian dress. Persian dress was as elaborate as the Assyrian costumes that we saw the kings wear in the Neo-Assyrian reliefs. All of these late imperial rulers are very snappy dressers. Darius also chose this style of rock-cut monument for his tomb. And this is a departure from Cyrus's tomb, which we'll come to in a minute. Darius's tomb was carved into the cliff face at Nakshi Rustam, a few miles from Persepolis. Darius's was the first of 3 Achaemenid royal tombs built there. And the site was significant because it was the location of a spring sacred to the Elamites. You remember the Elamites were the culture in southern Iran that were such important enemies for much of the period that we've discussed. This choice of site was surely deliberate on Darius's part as a way to connect him with this native past. A large cross-shaped relief was cut into the rock, and there's a small door that allows entrance into the tomb. Once again, as he had done at Behistun, Darius made it seem as if this monument could not have been created by humans. The base of the lowest part of the facade was a good 50 feet above ground level, and once again, they probably carved steps to allow them to construct the monument.